and welcome to Movies, Films, and Flicks. I am Mark Hoffmeyer, and joining me is a man that tangles away with money and steals all my cash. It's John Levengood.
Wait, margin call? Get him on the phone!
Hey, Tango, what's a margin call? Oh, man. Now I know why you love the movie Margin Call. Actually, you love Big Short. You love Margin Call. You like monies. You like movies about money, which is Tango and Cash.
Do good jobs explaining money.
Does Tango and Cash do a good job explaining money?
You know, not at all, but Tango and Cash does a great job of showing me how I think a villain shouldn't run his organization.
He's a micromanager. It's like, okay, remember the Scott Evil, Dr. Evil, John, where he's like, I got a gun. Let's just go in and kill him. Nah, we'll torture him. Like, in this one, he's like, we're going to frame him, put him in a prison, and then kill them. Because if we kill them on the streets, they become martyrs. But if we kill them in a prison, then they're just cops who went to prison. And then, but then he hires a whole gang to electrocute them when they could just club them.
This was such an unnecessary risk, too.
Yeah, and he shows up.
I don't get it. He makes so many high risk decisions in this movie that I feel like this is the how not to be a successful crime boss movie.
Yeah, study this movie and learn what not to do. Can I tell you something funny, John? Because we do a Kurt Russell movie every 25th episode. And what we like to do is just bring up random movies. So we're 375 deep. And so we went, okay, let's finally cover Tango and Cash. When I watched Tango and Cash when I was younger, it seemed just like every other late 80s action movie that we watched. It really did. I mean, in the opening chase in this film, okay, so you have Stallone shooting a semi. They stop 3 feet in front of him. That's all cocaine. Then you have Cash engaging in a car park chase scene that has a guy going, my car! And then just a random naked couple in a car. I mean, it's those 80s gratuitous wisecracking thing ever. And so you're younger, 12, you're like, yeah, this is cool. I get it. Like, they're hot shots, whatever. But the older you get and you watch this movie, you're like, this is a weird one. This had four directors. This one had a lot of on-screen. It went $20 million over budget. Like, this movie, the villain has a quarry where they have tractors, they have machine gun trucks, and they have monster cars seemingly waiting for someone to make an attack.
He had Mad Max Fury Road on reserve. And I think that after he went down, whoever took over just started Death Race with whatever was left.
Ah, yeah, exactly. I mean, it's Death Race what they're engaging in. They're driving around in a quarry, and with all this ADR, we're trapped in, we're locked, we're in a maze. And then they make their way to the base, and there's a self-destruct system. And there's a wall of mirrors.
Like a wizard's lair in Conan the Destroyer or whatever.
And I also love that Cash gets shot with the mythical, goes through right through the arm bullet and just stops bleeding. Like, no arteries, no nothing. Right. I love it though. I love the forgotten bullet wound. I like that Kiki, Tango's sister, is kidnapped by, the courier or Requin. And then she gets kidnapped. I messed up that name. And then she gets dropped and then Palance grabs her and it's just, but I gotta tell you, this movie has personality. Like, a lot of personality disorder. I've forgotten about so many action films, but watching this again, because, man, it's a whole different ballpark watching this when you're older than in college than when you're 13, and obviously every movie is. John.
I have a question for you about rewatching it now after you haven't seen it in a really long time.
Yeah.
Do you feel that everything leading up to their prison escape and then Kurt Russell meeting with Terry Hatcher at their place after he sees her at the club is what you remember? And then everything after that, the supervillain's lair, felt like some movie you never saw. It's like the octopus scene in The Goonies where you feel like this is where they all started dropping acid when they were making the movie.
That's an amazing point that you make, because in my head, having not watched this movie in 15 years, a long time, I thought this movie was mainly a prison break film.
Yes, absolutely.
I really did. I thought at the end when they get their leather belts and they slide down the thing, then it's just about over. Then they go to the guy's house and kill. I thought this was a prison escape movie. I did. Yes. In my head, I was like, this is a great prison escape film. But then I watched it again. They're out of that prison quite quick. And they really do Kiki a disservice by not telling her to leave town, because they just, they're being chased by a micromanaging billionaire villain, and they just let her chill at the house. It's a weird, and then Kurt Russell riding on a motorcycle away with her, and they're both, he's in drag.
And then she's in an Elvis outfit, and then she takes the Elvis jacket.
That gum smacking cop is one of the most annoying characters I've ever seen in my life.
Threesome?
Yeah, how about a threesome?
Any chance of a threesome?
And he's the most useless cop on the planet, just smacking his gum. And then she woos him on stage playing her drums so that Cash can escape. But this movie, man, I also wrote, after I watched it again, I sent you this long kind of like stream of consciousness message. And I was like, this is Hobbs and Shaw. You have two loners who are just the absolute best at what they do. You have one and two, or one and two, depending on the day, right? The best in the world. You have a sister that gets entangled with them. You have rain fights. You have every time that these two, electrocution, torture, and Hobbs and Shaw, they're electrocuted. When they are in danger, Hobbs and Shaw, all they do is make jokes. And that's all that these guys do, is make jokes. In the beginning scene, you have Dwayne Johnson and Statham going to different areas beating people up. And this one, you have two different action scenes where they go to a place and they're victorious. It's just they have disguises. Hobbs and Shaw has disguises in this. I know there's not family, there's no disease that's going to wipe out humanity, but it's essentially the same film, because Hobbs and Shaw, they're different, yes, but they're both awesome. In this movie, they're different, but they're both awesome. This isn't like an unawesome and awesome team up. Does that make sense?
This is
dual awesomes together. It's the weird, they call it a buddy cop movie, but I just think it's someone called it an odd couple. I'm like, this is not an odd couple, these two. These guys are basically brothers.
They do behave that way too, don't they?
Yeah. They I love it. And I just think there's so, there's just so much in this movie. I have so many notes that just, this is a unique one, man. And I'm glad that we decided on this, because I'm so happy to revisit it. Oh, it makes me so happy.
We're talking about the Jack Palance's, or Eve Perret's.
Yeah.
What a name. Lair at the end. This quarry modified into a death race arena with multiple trucks with rocket launchers.
Yes.
And then the big death race garbage trucks for demo. Like, I was waiting for Hobbs, Dom, and the team to come out and deal with this.
And there is kind of a quarry chase. Well, there's an abandoned factory chase in Hobbs and Shaw, right? Where they're chasing through this abandoned area. And then this one, they're in a quarry. And you're right. This is that car that they had. I mean, there's a note where they said that thing could hit 0 to 50 or 60 in 5 seconds.
I think it would rear and then fall back on itself. It would really flip over.
0 to 60 in 5.5 seconds. The RV from hell. It's beautiful, because this is not one movie. This is three movies.
It looked like you supercharged a 1979 Aerostar minivan.
Ah,
and then, it what was with that kitschy character who's basically their James Bond Q character, who's provisioning this weird war vehicle, and he's showing like the dog that shoots things and explodes, and
and Kurt Russell has a boot gun,
right?
And he nails a guy in the head while falling backwards,
right,
with the sister in the way.
They both shot at once and the sister's in the way. That is so utterly reckless.
Same bullet hole too. It's just like they both hit right in the perfect, they knew exactly where they were shooting.
80s cops could shoot, though. Remember when Mel Gibson, it was Lethal Weapon 1 or 2, or at the gun range, and he shoots two shots with his Glock, and then he takes out the little machine gun and gives it a smile?
Yeah. Yeah. But once again, this movie does put a smile on my face, because it's bonkers. This is not a boring stock. I mean, the banter between Stallone and Russell is, I mean, they're calling each other Pee-wee and like has one drop and like, why is your gun bigger than mine? It's just quips all the time between, I don't get it. And this movie was a success. It made a lot of money. It made like $163 million worldwide.
In 89.
Yeah. It made bank because, I mean, both actors were good. I mean, listen, Kurt Russell in this movie is effortless. He was, you know what? Okay, this is another thing. You and I have talked about a lot of Kurt Russell movies. This is a very unique Kurt Russell character. If you think about his overall filmography and what we've talked about. Because Big Trouble in Little China, Jack Burton, he's kind of a doofus. He doesn't have great aim. He has good reflexes. He's blustery, but he falls apart. So I guess Cash is Jack Burton. If there were twin brothers, one went into the force and military, the other one became a trucker.
Right.
Right? But then you have his like, Snake Plissken, who's just silent but deadly and just gets the job done, all business. That is not Cash. You have Captain Ron, who's super cheeky. Then you have Overboard, where he's a nice family guy. He's like a nice, like, the thing, MacReady. He's just a sullen dude destroying computers with whiskey in Antarctica. There's, like, you know, Silkwood, Swing Shift, where he's the romantic lead. And this one's a completely different. This is the, like, he woos Terry Hatcher. He gets a big massage, but he also kills people with
that. That is a faux sex scene.
Yeah.
I mean, it's very obviously, very quickly revealed to us it's a faux sex scene, but then they keep playing the gag and we start it over when Ray is showing up.
Yep.
And he's just like, oh, what's he doing to my sister? And they played that really well.
Oh, it's fun. I mean, everybody on this set, I mean, Stallone really, he's trying really hard. You have Russell knows exactly what this movie is. He could do this in his sleep. You could tell Stallone liked the property. He was having a good time with it. It's just Stallone was doing interviews and he was saying, yeah, this is kind of going to be like a Lethal Weapon. This is going to be like a 48 Hours. This is what I want this movie to be. This will be like those. So did it seem like his response? This was 89. This does not feel like an 89 movie, John. This, right? This feels like a 83. Am I crazy?
Yeah, it's definitely like riding the coattails of not exploitation cinema, but kind of like the canon movie era of ridiculous action movies. This feels like the second half feels like a canon film.
Yeah, it really does. Absolutely. There's an evil lair.
Such an evil lair. So this evil
lair. We're bouncing all over the place, but it makes me happy.
Not only is it the compound that we described with the death race, right, going on in the Mad Max Fury Road, but when you get inside, Jack Palance's, like, desk is in this huge, sprawling, billionaire's stainless steel, ill-lit room, right, with a bar and these very widespread out, like, seating arrangement, almost like it's a rich person's speakeasy. He has this setup for these mice in a maze. And I'm just wondering, like, did he just have that made to give his presentation to his criminal business partners? Or does he use this for all of his presentations and somehow use the mice in this big maze setup? And he has UCLA interns who are setting this stuff up for him. He had a video montage on those 25 TVs behind him when he was talking about the problem of Tango and Cash to James Hong and that other bad guy.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
James Hong also from Big Trouble in Little China, as it turns out.
Love it.
He has like a video montage prepared for it. Like he clearly has UCLA interns who are putting this together.
I think he loves those mice. When he picks them up and smells them, there is a real believable love of those. It's not even menacing, John. It's not like
right, he would kill it, right?
I'm looking at you going, ha ha, then he feeds them to snakes. He's holding these things up to his nose like, come to daddy. I love you. So maybe, yeah, he's very bonded with those two. So maybe the maze is real. And maybe he just uses that, like you said, with the triads, with the Yakuza who are coming in town, with the mafia, with all the different, just different criminal groups. They all visit him. He shows them this.
Like, everyone responds well to a mouse maze. Everyone understands it.
I mean, it's fun to watch. Like, put money on who gets through the fastest, right?
Well, he really doesn't seem to pay much attention, does he? No. He really just wants you to watch him put them in the maze, and then he's going to wax poetic about how, no, we don't kill them.
Look back at me. Some guy, though, Nathan Rabin, not some guy, but he was writing about this movie, and he said something really random, and I want to see what you think about it. He said that Jack Palance delivers all of his lines as if he's in the midst of a powerful orgasm.
That's... okay, I appreciate that cheeky exaggeration. I would say that he always seems like a supernatural villain who thinks in the moment of every sentence that his plan is just coming to fruition. But I totally get what this guy is saying. That's the kind of thing I'd have fun writing in a review, I think.
Yeah.
I totally get where he's coming from there. But yeah, when he's talking, though, he is... reveling in his own sermon. It's like he can't believe how impressed he is with the words coming out of his mouth and how satisfied he is that he's certain that this is all going to work out so perfectly. Like, well, oh, what happens when they eventually get out of prison? What makes you think they'll ever get out? Like, he's always just so on point. He's like Skeletor in Masters of the Universe.
Yes. He's doing a Frank Langella.
He is doing Summerstock Shakespeare, and no one else got the memo.
He's in another movie entirely in this. And it's just, I know the phrase has been beat to death, but he really did just turn it up to 11. But you also have to think about this guy. He had $1 billion in cocaine caught in a truck. $1 billion. $1 billion, John. Okay.
He was not hedging his bets.
No, you should have separated that between 10 trucks. You should have. You should have put it in your undertaker or gravedigger monster truck and gone through the back roads.
I'd like to add to that. So if he drove by, presumably within an hour, right, because it was the crime scene, within an hour or so of the crime scene, remember he drove by in his limo? If he was close enough by to do that drive-by, did he suspect that his plan was going to be foiled with $1 billion in cocaine?
Wow. Yeah, I mean, he must have. It seems like a kind of cartoon world, John, where Cash gets $30 million of his cocaine here. Tango gets $40 million of his cocaine here. Cash goes and gets $10 million over here. It's like a comic thing where they just keep grabbing his cocaine. Like, these kids are always getting my cocaine. Okay. Here's $1 billion of cocaine that he has paid for. This man, Eves, is the lead drug dealer in the United States.
At the time, I mean, almost certainly, if that's one, that's wholesale, Mark.
Yeah.
That's wholesale. The street value is probably what? Going to be 8-10 fold? I realize he has overhead, right?
Well, but yes, his RV army.
Right. I don't know what it costs to, like, run AC in that huge lair, by the way.
Oh, yeah.
In L.A.? But that's his power bill aside. He's clearly got an overhead, but he's got to be grossing like tenfold that, right? I don't know my drug economics well. Maybe it's fivefold that, but like $5 billion, and maybe he ends up netting $3 or $4 billion or more. I don't know how this works.
Yeah, if you pull in $2 billion, you're pretty much set, right?
I mean, I'm just struggling to understand how he'd have $1 billion in overhead.
Imagine this, John. You're John, the cocaine man, Levingood. You start working out of Tampa, Florida. You eventually expand over into St. Pete. Then you get a hold in Tarpon Springs to get some boats through the Gulf. Then you kind of expand a little bit. Oh, I'm very Florida right now. And you go, over to like Lakewood, Lakeland. You go south a little bit to Sarasota, eventually make your way to Miami. You get to Jacksonville, you get to Tally. You have all the major cities. In Florida, Naples, you are the person. If one of your trucks with $1 billion of cocaine is taken, you're out of business.
I don't know how you had that money to get it in the first place. So I imagine I don't care how rich he is. He leveraged that and Colombians or whoever are giving him this and he is going to sell it and then pay them, I think, what he owes them. I have a feeling that the story that's not being told here is that he's in big trouble if this doesn't work out for him.
Yeah.
And realistically, it didn't work out because the drugs were seized.
Yep. Does not work out.
I feel like he's getting assassinated by a hit squad of Colombians.
And he paid an assassin to attack Cash.
I'm not saying he wasn't talented.
Extremely talented.
To a layperson, but as far as eliminating someone who cost you $1 billion, well, actually, that wasn't him, but yeah, that was that was Sly who did it. By the way, someone who is such a financial threat to you, I feel like he should have been upping the game a little more.
Mm-hmm. And didn't that assassin shoot him exactly in his bulletproof vest so that he would go to a prison and be tortured and give him that name to then get them to the site to be arrested together?
Was that the case?
Yeah.
It felt like he was trying to kill him, but what you're saying makes a lot of sense to the story.
Because he went, oh, my vest. Oh, man, this is a $9 shirt. And then they gave him a name. So, okay, nobody knew who Jack Palance's character was. Nobody. They didn't even know his name. So if they hired an assassin, that assassin had Cash dead to rights. Had him. Lift that bullet up 5 inches. Boom. Shoot him in the leg. He's that good of a shot. Shoot him in the leg. In an artery. Boom. Done. Man. It's... Yeah, who cares if the cop force makes them martyrs? You're not losing $30 million, $50 million, $1 billion anymore.
$1 billion. So I had an observation, and the first time I rewatched this of several times in preparation for our recording here. So in the very beginning of the movie, Stallone's driving along, right? He's going to go do this bust. He's being warned that he's almost out of his jurisdiction, right? Now, eventually, he shoots up the truck. For some reason, it comes to a halt, by the way. I don't know why it didn't run right over him. Even if he blew the tires, I think he'd be roadkill. But that aside, he shoots it out. Eventually, the sheriff shows up. It is revealed that he, in fact, was out of his jurisdiction.
Yep.
I want your badge. Well, guess what? In 1989 cop movies, in the 80s cop movies, all of our main cops, they're doing things out of their jurisdiction, right? Die Hard, all of our cops. Lethal Weapon, they skirt some lines too, right? Mel Gibson in Part 2 with the South African people who all have diplomatic immunity. He is pulling some fireable shenanigans left and right. And it's mm-hmm. the kind of thing where – this compromises the case and they get off. So when he does this, if this was a 2021 movie, a 2021 movie, would they just get off because he was out of his jurisdiction and they never had any right to search and seizure? And now he just assaulted somebody out of his jurisdiction.
Whoa.
And caused woeful harm to them. He's going to jail. He's losing. He's out of a job and going to jail for that. And they're like, no, you can't touch these guys. You never had a right to search anything. And then they get off. In a modern movie, the cops are always getting horribly punished. And the most dangerous criminals are being set free. And that's the beginning of the movie, right? Mm-hmm. Where the criminals are going free because the cops didn't follow the rules. In old movies, this clearly a glowing example, our cops are always breaking the rules. But, oh, as long as we found what we were looking for, it doesn't set a good modern example, does it? Mm-hmm. As long as we find what we were looking for, everything's fine. It's an interesting thing to reflect on, but the cop movies of our youth, anyway, I can't speak for all of our listeners, are setting the example that breaking the rules is okay as long as your assumption was correct. And in reality, that's how bad guys get off.
That's funny because you see so many movies where you're out of your league and then they shoot it and the cocaine comes out, or they smack something and it comes out when they're all out of their jurisdiction. Those guys would go free unless the cop said, you were never here. We found this. And then there's a cover up that happens, which could get ugly. But that taught bad lessons. You're out of your jurisdiction. But if you can catch $1 billion in cocaine, $1 billion in cocaine.
And with what he did to those guys in that truck, he broke his leg, his ribs, and his jaw.
Yeah.
Robert Zadar, when he flew through that windshield. When the sheriff comes up and they see this LA cop, it's like, you're getting cuffed. You will never get to shoot that truck to reveal that there were drugs. And they checked the other chambers and they didn't find drugs. So you're just going to jail. The prisoners are getting off.
Yep.
And now any investigation in the future is hampered because of how horribly this was handled. It's an interesting thing. I'm not trying to say I don't love the way that it played out, but it's funny just putting a remotely realistic lens. And I'm not trying to make these movies realistic.
This is the last action hero world right here.
Kind of, yeah. Right? Because whatever. That there is one tough cop.
Yeah. The chief yells at him for a while.
Line of the 80s and early 90s, too, by the way.
Yeah. The chief yells at him for a little bit. You know how many rules you broke? You're going to go under for this. You're going to get your badge. You're going to do this. But it's a good thing you're a good cop and you found $1 billion of cocaine. Now get out of here. I don't want to see your face again. Hey, that sounds like every chief in a cop movie.
Well, that was 80s. Arnold Schwarzenegger's chief. Yeah. Absolutely. And last action hero.
Oh, I love it.
It's Joe Pantaleone in Bad Boys. Yeah,
Woosa. Playing bad basketball and doing all that. Yeah, you guys broke every rule. Oh, you know, it's paperwork we're going to have to do. Oh, man.
Speaking of Bad Boys, do you think that Sylvester Stallone influenced the Mike Lowry character?
I'm Mike Lowry. Oh.
A wealthy, well-dressed guy who just likes the action, doesn't need the money at all, puts himself at risk, doesn't have a family. Not, you know, his own nuclear family.
And he has a sister, right?
Yes.
No, is that Gabrielle Union? Or is that – whose sister is that?
Gabrielle Union was Martin Lawrence's sister. But still, similar scenario, right? Like, that's a very Mike Lowry character. We didn't have characters like that. Although Dolph Lundgren in the original Punisher kind of seemed like it. That guy had a very posh apartment that didn't get explained.
Like, I was just thinking about that, too. Showdown Little Tokyo, but that was 91. So this is 89. And if we think about the cop movies, we had Danny Glover trying to fix his boat. We had Mel Gibson living in a trailer on the beach. In 48 Hours, they weren't wealthy. Axel Foley never had any of that. What an interesting role to play, John. You're just the best cop in the world, and you're also a millionaire. And he's not very nice to his sister. He's not.
I think I think that there was kind of like a raising his little sister dynamic. So he's like kind of big brother, but kind of like pseudo dad.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I got that vibe too.
He clearly doesn't approve of what she's doing because she calls it a dance tour. I don't know what this dance tour was, but we kind of see her being what I will call a clothes on showgirl.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Yeah.
Like, that's fair. Like, it's almost like going to a cabaret club or something, and she's doing her little drum show and everything, but all the guys there are there because they want to hoot and holler.
They are very supportive in that club.
There's no... The bartender?
But also, he did make that guy wait 15 minutes for beer, though. Like, that's a long wait. I've been waiting 15 minutes. They had a really... You know, there's so many extra characters in this movie, right? So... In the beginning, we have all the cops yelling at Stallone. There's so many cops. I feel like there's 40 cops yelling at Stallone. Like, hey, Rambo, Rambo's a wimp. Then you have the car park chase with the couple in the car, and then the guy who got his car stolen. And then there's just so many different characters in the prison. You have the guy with the jaw. I have his name. You have the guy with...
Robert Zadar is the actor.
Yeah, you have him in there. Then you have Breon James. Like, there's other characters, and then
Clint Howard
as Slinky. then they get out, and then they have the Q guy, then they have the guy that falsified the audio, then you have the other cop. It's just, and then you have the smacking gum cop. There's just so many. Then you have James Huang in here, and the other guy that he's with, who the other criminal leader. I mean, it's just, there are so many, I think it's Mark Alamo, who plays Lopez, I think that's the guy's name. You have so many extra characters. I don't know how you feel about that, but there's just so many extra, I don't know, people.
I wouldn't have thought of it until you just brought it up, but it makes total sense.
I know a good movie, you have good supporting characters. But this one, it just feels like there's so many, John. So many people have lines.
Well, I mean, you got the corrupt police captain.
Yep.
You've got Jeffrey Lewis was there. I think a captain or something superior. Jeffrey Lewis from Double Impact. I like that guy.
Mm-hmm.
He didn't do a whole lot of stuff, but yeah, they've got a lot of actors who, when you think about it, have their memorable share of lines.
There's a lot of characters in this movie. I don't know if that's good or bad, John. It's
well,
just...
it wasn't good for the budget, apparently, as you described.
Yeah.
Although I think most of that was the villain lair with the mirror room. I still can't get over the mirror room. That is such a Marvel supervillain or evil wizard thing to have. He just had that. He had that installed, Mark. At some point, he contacted a contractor or had his assistant contact a contractor. And he gave them specs for his mirror room.
Oh, man. Such a it's just so...
I'd like to see the full floor plan to understand if the mirror room really is just, like, at the corner of the interior of the lair, and it's just there in case shit. Like, I don't understand.
That production designer on this movie, though, that he had... that dude had his work cut out for him, J. Michael Riva. That guy, he built a lot of sets, John. He was very busy. But you want to hear what else he worked on? This guy, I just look, Lethal Weapon, Lethal Weapon 2, Tango and Cash, A Few Good Men, Dave, North, Congo, Hard Rain, that'd have been a nightmare. 6 Days, 7 Nights, Lethal Weapon 4, he did Evolution, heck yeah. They moved on to Stealth, Spider-Man 3, Iron Man, Iron Man 2, The Amazing Spider-Man, then Django Unchained.
And in all these, he's doing the set design?
Yeah, production design. But imagine, design. I would have loved to have been on that set and just be like, hey, any of these, like a downtime. Excuse me, sir. Can you tell me about Tango and Cash? Because four directors were on this movie, John.
He's like, how much scotch do you have?
Ah! Oh, yeah. He would probably just walk away and just get me fired because he doesn't want to think about it. I mean, they had a director. They fired the director because he was going like too seriously. And then they brought it. So they had the director, Andrei Chonskalevsky. Then they brought in Albert Magnoli, and then they had Stallone coming in to do some shoots. Then they brought in different editors. This movie, like, why was there so many behind the scenes problems? It seems there were a lot of reshoots too, and that's why maybe it's so disjointed. Maybe there was more time in the prison, and then maybe the ending was reshot. Maybe it was more grounded and they needed more action.
It does feel like it starts out, regardless of the $1 billion drug bust. It starts out again, like half of this movie is about as grounded as you'd get for a Stallone and Kurt Russell, you know, framed cop movie. And then after that, like, it's just Thunderdome.
Yeah.
Like it is bonkers Thunderdome. You know,
I kept
so they go to prison.
Chuck Norris from the 80s to pop out.
They go to prison, right? Jack Palance makes a big deal about how we don't want to kill them because we'll be at war with the police. No one knows who he is. So if they had an assassin just bomb his house, right? Because they're not watching out for anything, like you said. I agree. They're at war with nothing. There's an investigation. But I'd like to think that he can hire people, you know, with the wherewithal to make that problematic. You know, I don't think he'd be at war with anybody. I'm on James Hong's side.
This dude had enough money to create fake audio, pay cops. Sure, Tango and Cash are made martyrs, but they could have been set up at a scene. They could have shown up to a scene like he could have demolition manned them. They show up to a scene. There's the crime scene. There's 8 dead people. They get blown up. And then you learn later on through he probably owns the press because you know how many headlines are in this movie? So many headlines. You have so many press articles, you have cops, you have judges, you have audio, different people cutting together audio equipment. You could just say Tango and Cash rushed to a scene, made a mistake, blew it up, they're dead.
Right, and then they find the audio, and oh, crooked cops, and well, I guess they got their due. And then that's when Jack Palance can really say to his two apparently subordinate, or we'll just call them lower financial investing criminal partners, now that Tango and Cash are gone, your men do not need to be afraid. When he says that, it's so funny. You don't need to be afraid any longer. It's
because the two of them are just wiping out 30 million, 40 million. Just blow the guys up.
See, the problem is Jack Palance's character's problem, Yves Perret's problem, is that he really is a supernatural wizard villain or an X-Men supervillain who wants revenge more than he wants to win. His winning is in the revenge, and the revenge must create suffering, and therein lies his fault.
That's true. That's the classic villain trope.
All the abilities to have solved it, but I wish that they kind of just let his character do that, because the way he spoke, you can feel the arrogance and the narcissism.
That's too
good for them. They need to suffer. You know, like, okay, I get it. But instead, we're just giving them opportunities.
Okay, so James Hong, right? I read somewhere that he was Triad. There's a lot of money in the Triads, and the Triads are being costed money. So they could hire somebody and just not tell Eves and blow him up. And even if they are made martyrs, and then when Eves goes to them, hey, did you guys know anything about this? No. You told us not to. We trusted you. Like, why? Or they could go to him. Why'd you do it? You told us not to. We've been wanting to do this for years. Maybe they couldn't have blown him up, John. Maybe they try and they just can't do it.
I mean, I'm sure they're terrified of Jack Palance.
Yeah, that's true.
Because he's clearly the top dog. It's like he's the CEO and they each only have 5% of the company.
This dude has Thunderdome.
He does, though, doesn't he? It's like those two, our protagonists, end up in The Running Man at the end of this movie. It's so full tilt crazy.
Oh, I love it. I love it.
How did we not see another headline at the end of the movie? LA's two best cops exonerated for being framed for flippity floppity flip and taking down the supervillain's lair in a quarry outside of LA? Like, what is going on here?
$1 billion.
How do you get all those missile launchers?
Wow. And did you see the warehouse with all the weapons just laid out on tables?
So much. That was like a junior version of the huge warehouse at the end of Raiders of the Lost Ark.
Yes. Huge. So many weapons.
He had all the ammunition.
So many weapons. I don't know who this – I want to hear his origin story. Like, this is a Scarface thing where Scarface doesn't die by a hit. He dies because of Tango and Cash and a boot gun. All right, so how about this? Let's take a quick break, and then when we come back, we will talk more Tango and Cash. We will be right back. Welcome back to Movies, Films, and Flicks. And I got to tell you, John, I am getting sick of all the grime, crime, and slime in this city. I love that line. Terry Hatcher.
What are we gonna do about it?
Terry Hatcher's really game in this movie, though. I mean, she holds her own with these guys, I would say. I don't know if you don't, but
I'll say, on first rewatch in a long time, I felt that she was done the disservice of the typical female love interest in one of these movies. And as I watched it a few more times, again in the last month, I come to realize, like, the nudity is just the guys, their butts, right?
And the shower together, calling each other P-Way.
I mean, she is, we never so much as see, well, I mean, we see her in her showgirl outfit. Mm-hmm. But when it comes to the faux sex scene, she's like wearing a robe.
Yeah.
Like, it's not like her brother catches her in a thong and bra. Well, she might have that, but she's wearing a robe. And so it's like, and the faux sex scene, not a real sex scene. So it's a little more respectful to that character. It's just, we're just playing a gag. And the whole thing where Kurt Russell ends up in drag, right?
And she rides away on the motorcycle. She drives the motorcycle.
Right. And all of the assertive moments she has with the male characters. And so really, at the end, when I think about it, the only thing – I don't mean to call it a direct disservice, but when I just think of the tropes of 80s movies and female characters, these love interest characters, it's really just that she has this kind of – showgirl job.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And she's probably just trying to make it in the dance industry. And this is where you start. She's in her 20s and, you know, she wants to go on this tour. She wants to get exposure. Presumably the tour is something more interesting than what she's doing in some club.
Like in Magic Mike, the second one.
Whatever it is. But she's trying. She cares about it. Right.
Yeah.
It's not like she's just doing it for beer money. So, yeah, she has that job, and that's the trope. Otherwise, I mean, she seems interested in Kurt Russell, right?
Yeah.
So it's not like when he says, well, either way, I'm going to date your sister when all this is over. Well, we know that she has a choice and we have a feeling that she's interested. You know what I mean? So yeah. It's not like they're, it's not like he's just speaking for her interest. So again, so my first watch was before I knew we were going to podcast about this soon last year. And that was when I kind of had that disservice vibe, but I was cooking in the kitchen. I wasn't paying close attention. And then when, again, on revisiting, this is way, way, way less, or let's just say that it is not carrying the chauvinist properties that we would expect of a movie of its era. I mean, even Bird on a Wire, which has ever an inkling of the Kurt Russell, Terry Hatcher dynamic with Goldie Hawn and Mel Gibson.
Mm-hmm.
Goldie Hawn is going up a ladder. Mel Gibson is under her. She's wearing a skirt. He looks up. She says, don't look. You know, it's like they're playing a lot of maleness.
Yeah. In this movie. And, yeah.
And not that Bird on a Wire was specifically disrespectful for its era. But, you know, this movie was – this crazy-ass movie, Mark, might have been one of the more wholesome 80s cop movies with regards to its female characters. Now, and I'll say Die Hard, though, didn't pull any punches. It, our one main female character is a strong character.
Yeah, Bonnie Bedelia.
Right.
Oh, for
yeah.
sure.
Yeah, she was great in that. But these are unusual things.
Yeah, that did not happen in the – I'm so glad we're past that. I, you know what I was just looking at, though? 89 was the year of – we were just talking about movies at the time, but it was a year of big change. I mean, you had Batman coming in, kind of rocking the world. You had Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade. But in 89, listen to these scrappy action movies that came out. Roadhouse.
Mm.
Kickboxer. Best of the Best. Cyborg. License to Kill was a scrappy Bond movie. Then you had just as like monster action sci-fi movies, Deep Star 6, Leviathan, Blind Fury, Blue Steel.
Oh, with Rucker Howard.
Yeah. You had Next of Kin, Dead Bang with Don Johnson, Black Rain. I said Next of Kin already, but these are some really scrappy 1989 action movies. It's a kind of an interesting year for action. Just very... cult classic-y, very, it was like, because if you think about 92 and then working your way up, then 94 you had Speed and True Lies. This was a very, 89 was a very transitional year, it seems like.
This was like the experiment year.
Yeah.
This was like the exploding RV in the desert because of a meth cook movie. Like except it worked in this case. But with how this movie changes halfway down, right, from our standard to our bonkers kind of chapters, like they were throwing things on the wall, and if it stuck, they're like, yeah, let's do it.
Wait, that stuck? Yeah.
I mean, and then we're gonna have all these SUVs. With missile launchers.
Oh, what? Gosh.
It's like, yeah, it's going to be, but it's okay because they're in a 1979 Aerostar that we made into a war machine. Huh? Oh, right. But after they take out the rocket launcher SUVs or pickup trucks, then there's going to be these huge dump trucks that come try to demo them.
What? Out of nowhere.
But then they're going to overtake them and they're going to take it and get into the lair. Like, it's so over the top.
So over the top. And even the prison fight scene is over the top. Because Stallone opens it up with a front kick that sends a burly person flying. Then he throws a backhand that knocks a large prisoner 6 feet back in the air. It's such a... Yeah, I know it's not what we were just talking about with the car chase and the ramp. Like, and also, those cars really snuck up on him in the car. The rearview mirrors on that vehicle are not very good because those two tractors got on either side of them.
They just appeared.
Yeah.
They were like, what do they call them? Blackbird fighter jets. They just, you don't know them until they are firing on you.
What did you think about the prison fight scene with the electrocution that's very Hobbs and Shawian and where they just pulverize at least 30 criminals?
You know, this whole scene, though, this goes back to what I would call like one of the hugest unnecessary risks other than not having them assassinated. Jack Palance, like, he had to slip out. Like, people came and broke that up. He wasn't expecting. Like, what if he got... And he was just drifting off alone. Like, his goons were busy in the fray. How does goons get out? How Rakim get out of that? I don't know. I guess bribery. But, like, what if Jack Palance got snagged by some guard, right? I mean...
And these were good guards because they came with the assistant warden, who was the one honest guy there.
Right. So risky, right? And they're electrocuted. First off, and also, Jack Palance's goons let out a bunch of prisoners. Now, I'll assume maybe they were all on payroll, right? Yeah. But if they are questioned, right, if this goes awry, who's to say that they aren't going to talk? Or maybe they're conditioned to know they're going to get murdered or something. But, I mean, there's so many risks involved. They could talk about it. It could be discovered that this happened. But yeah, so then they electrocute him. That was interesting. I'm just sitting there thinking, like, did they do experiments to know how to do this enough that they don't kill them? Because Jack Palance doesn't want them killed. He wants them to remain in prison and be punished. He doesn't say what makes you think they'll survive. He says what makes you think they're ever going to get out.
Yeah.
I suppose that could be considered ambiguous, but
it makes no sense. It really doesn't.
I think that he wanted them to stay in prison indefinitely. The level of risk involved, just huge.
I have another question for you. In this film, they are always outnumbered, outmatched, getting killed, getting shot at. They've been shot. They're getting beat up in a prison. They're having cars. Like when the cars drive at them, what does he say to them about the jewelry? When the one guy drives up here, wait, hold, I have a really good quote here. Oh, glad you could drop in. And he's like, do you like jewelry? And then the guy says, F you. And then Ray goes, I prefer blondes.
Yeah.
And it's, do you think that hurts the movie? Because when they're in prison, they're quipping. When they're about to fight, they're quipping. When they're escaping, they're quipping. Now it does make for a very quick viewing experience. This movie does go by rather quickly, but it takes all of the, there's no tense moments in this film. There's not,
there's no gravity.
There's not 1 ounce, John, of tension in this. I never once was on the edge of my seat. If anything, I was just reclining in my seat because I'm just so relaxed watching it. Now that may make for a really good TNT movie, but I think it hurts the overall effectiveness of it. So, I mean, Keanu and Sandra Bullock, they had jokes in Speed, but you felt the tension. True Lies.
Right.
We talked about that on the podcast. There's jokes there, but you also feel the tension in it. This one, not 1 ounce of tension.
Right.
Not one. And is that good or bad?
You are meant to never have a moment where you forget that you know the heroes get out of this fine.
Yeah. Is that good or bad?
Is that bad? I don't know that it's bad, but I think that it keeps you from being a slightly better film, and it locks you more into this movie or flickdom.
Yeah.
And there's nothing wrong with that, and it's highly rewatchable and very enjoyable. When we talk about how great Tango and Cash is, we keep it to generalities, and then we talk about how crazy it is. But when we talk about True Lies, I can talk about how funny and how crazy so many parts are, but then I can talk about how grand did a lot of like the family protective moments were, you know, or how satisfying and warm it is when after their kind of marital issues and discourse, when he says, come on, baby, and she jumps and gets his hand out of that limo before it goes off of the broken bridge in the Keys. You know, like you feel so good when this happens. So in this movie, yeah, it has a lot of fun things that are fun to watch. You feel good because it's fun, but there's no emotional journey whatsoever.
None.
The Fifth Element. Totally bonkers.
Yeah.
Totally bonkers, but has a lot of very heartfelt, warm, touching, memorable, affecting scenes. This has zero of that as well. So it's not just the jokes and the action keeping it from anything that could be mistaken for a film, right?
Mm-hmm.
But it's that there is no heart in it whatsoever. These guys have no, they don't overcome anything internally in this whole movie.
They're the same people.
Right. Nothing has changed. They overcame a bad guy, but there's no personal victory at all. Maybe they made friends, I don't know, but they're really still kind of kitschy frenemies anyway. They're just less enemy than friend at the end.
Yeah,
they're always going to be quippy at Thanksgiving. Mm-hmm. If he marries Terry Hatcher,
oh, that's gonna be a nightmare.
they're still going to be at each other about everything. Yo, you can't base a turkey like that. You got to do it. You know, there's always going to be something going on.
Let me deep fry this turkey. What? Deep fry?
You're going to blow the house up. This is my house. I pay the mortgage. She just lives here.
She pays rent and lives there, and he just walks in whenever. Jeez Louise. Now, I want to bring something else up, too, where when I think about, let's see, Predator, you have this elite force of alphas who go and they decimate that force, that first force that they attack. So you establish them as alphas, and then you kill them. Then you have Arnold. Then you get Arnold freaking out and having to go back to nature to win. That is effective because you build alphas, they lose, then they have to do that. You have the same thing with aliens, where you have this elite group coming in, they get handed to them, they all die. Then at the end, still you have this queen who's an amazing villain. The fight between the queen alien and Ripley and the power loader. I think that's sometimes what separates. There and like Hans Gruber too. I think Die Hard, Hans Gruber. So you have Bruce Willis. He shows up to Bonnie Bedelia's place, John McClane, and he just. There's scenes though in the movie where he's like, "You're such an idiot. Why do you do this to yourself?" Remember when he argues with her? He's like, "You're so dumb. All you want to do is see your wife." And then when he has the glass in his feet and he's talking with Reginald Vell Johnson about how he shot the kid and he thinks he's gonna die. And then Hong, Gruber almost tricks him with the gun. Then they play that joke. There's learning in it. There's tension. There's a good villain. You have a hero that's somewhat three-dimensional. Those are the classics in my mind. Right, those are A tier. Then you have Tango and Cash, which is the cult classic tier, which is the FX. If it's on at 2 o'clock, you leave it on because there's no stakes, which makes it. So sometimes some of these movies are very draining. As much as I love True Lies, all the scenes with Bill Pullman with his wife, it's very, it's beautiful, but it's draining. This movie, there's nothing draining. There's no anything in it. So it makes it a very breezy, rewatchable film. Which, like you said, it puts in the film's flicks territory, but far away from the action classics. Right. Not every movie. I know it's weird. Some people go watch Joe Dirt and they're like, "Well, it's not an Oscar winner, but it's good." It's like, "Well, I never thought Joe Dirt was going to be an Oscar winner." So I don't think Tango and Cash wanted to be that way. I'm just saying what separates it from the best.
When you have pickup trucks with missile launchers, I think we've departed from the Oscar conversation.
Yeah, exactly. Or like, you know, it's nothing groundbreaking, but it's good. It's like, I don't think Tango and Cash thought it was. And I think it really wanted to entertain, and it does. But it's very, I hate using this word, though, but it's very uneven. This is not one movie that we're watching. And yeah, and it is separated from the best.
You commented four directors.
Yeah.
So could you expound on that?
Yeah, here, I have all my notes up here. So let's see.
Because I didn't know that, by the way.
Yeah, so they, let's see. Well, it was the 80s. Tango is something of a troubled production with director Andre Chonkolovsky. Sorry about that. I messed that up. Replaced for reshoots by Albert Magnoli, who did Purple Rain. Magnoli, I probably said that wrong again. But such replacements and rewrites probably aren't to blame for the picture's general incoherence, which culminates in the era's that. But then that guy, Albert Magnoli, he got fired because he went over budget on the reshoots that he was doing. So then Sly helped take it home. And then another editor came in to direct it. So all told, there were four different people who had direction in this movie.
What a tortured production.
But what's tortured about? What's tortured?
Well, I mean, just the behind the scenes, yeah. Right?
No. I'm just saying, like, you know what I love, though? If this was The Revenant, okay, that's a tortured production. I get why people quit and come in and out. Mad Max Fury Road. But this movie, it had a big budget to begin with. It had big star. I just don't understand the... This is the main thing I also want to ask you. The original director wanted to make the movie very serious. There is not that movie in this movie. Not one bit of this movie is serious. So maybe when they say serious, he didn't want trucks with rocket launchers.
Sure.
And that scene reeks of reshoots.
Or mirror rooms.
He probably wanted these two cops, relatively grounded, $1 billion in cocaine, go to prison, have a hell of a time in there, get out, go on a small-scale thing of revenge, and there's no room of mirrors. But they had some very expensive reshoots, so I bet you it was the Chucks. I bet you, like, he didn't want that. They wanted more. They brought another director. That director went over budget because they had monster trucks. They brought in another director. Sly finished it. So, yeah, maybe when they say grounded and let more serious, I'm going to say this the eighth time again, no cavernous weapons labs, no smelling of mice. He just wanted a meat and potatoes escape plan-esque movie, I guess. Not this. Oofta. It's, but I love it. Watching this again. Megan was coming in.
Fun.
Yeah, Megan was coming in and out of this movie. She was working on something. And so she was coming in and out watching the various scenes of this movie. And she's like, what is, like, what? Not in a bad way. She was like, wait, I thought they were in prison. And,
cause like, this are you was watching the same movie?
Yeah. They were in prison. So in the beginning, she saw the cops battling. And then they were in prison. She's like, why are they in prison? And I was like, well, this, cause this happened. And then later on, when there was the monster truck rally, she's like, what? What's happening now? And I'm like, I can't even. I tried to explain this movie to Megan in like 20 words or less. Two awesome cops are framed for murder, go to jail, escape, have a monster truck rally.
Have a monster truck rally. Defeat the mirror room villain.
Right. It's a.
then they defeat the wizard.
Yeah. Defeat the wizard. It's beautiful. I love it. I'm glad we talked about it. I mean, it's just a gnarly little thing. And listen, I like the guns. I like that Kurt Russell's like, who messed with my sight? Someone messed with his sight. Like, this guy controls everything in this town. And then what about the bump uglies line? You're like, oh man, Stallone, like, you bumping uglies with my sister? And you're like,
I'll say, you know, there was one departure for me of being in this bonkers movie. And that actually was, when Kurt Russell's talking about his sight being off. I feel like at that point, if he is that aware, right, that he just picked it up and caught that. It's not like he was at a gun range. He just knew this is wrong. I feel like he's going to stop and look and realize that the serial number is dead. Like, he's going to think of something.
Yeah.
And know this is not his gun.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? I'm not saying this is some soundly exquisitely written thing otherwise, but that was something where I can't rationalize it with Jack Palance's, it with Eve Perret's arrogance for why he's doing what he's doing. And they just didn't happen to put it into words for us, but I can read that between the ultra sinister lines, right? Mm-hmm. But Kurt Russell, I feel like Cash is going to notice this, that he's going to realize something's wrong, and that would have led to, now, sure, maybe he realizes it's not his gun. That doesn't change the fact that later they have something to go. They have a lead to follow. They go follow that lead, and his gun is there. We get to the same place. It didn't keep us from getting there.
Yeah.
I suppose if he reported it as missing, but even still, the framing was so good with that video editing, right? Right, with the audio editing, he's getting nailed anyway. But mm-hmm. there was one little thing. I feel like one or two lines of dialogue could have clinched that up, just like the Jack Palance, why don't we just kill them? You know, one or two lines of dialogue would have gone a long way, but I'm not saying that it hurt the movie. It was just a small flaw, you know, and a very mm-hmm. small flaw in a very Jackson Pollock of an action movie of things sprayed on a wall and presented as a finished product that somehow pleases, right?
It's fun.
It's a very satisfying movie.
Because it's eight movies. It's like you're getting the best of four movies in an hour and a half. And it's not even that long.
But we go back to our Die Hard and True Lies comparisons, or even a Joe Dirt comparison. When this movie's over, I'm just like, yeah, that was fun.
Yeah.
You know? Whereas Joe Dirt, like, I'm so happy that he finds resolution and he realizes that this girl liked him the whole time, even though he never thought that something like that was possible. You know, Dennis Leary mentions it to him, the radio host, and it's like a great revelation. And we knew the whole time watching it, but it feels so good. It's so emotionally satisfying, right? True Lies ends. He's tangoing with his wife
mm-hmm.
that he used to be lying to about all this stuff. Now she's in on it and she loves it. And Tom Arnold is complaining from the van that yeah. he's tired of being in the van. I'm not going to be in the van. And then you just hear the music continuing, and it's so satisfying. Die Hard, don't even get me started. So satisfying. That Christmas movie, listeners.
Very satisfying. Well, yeah, it is a Christmas movie.
But again, this one ends, and whatever. I watched it 3 times in a month, and I had a very enjoyable time watching it 3 times in a month each time. But when it's over, I'm just like, yeah, that's fun.
And you go on with your day.
I'm going to finish cooking now. Like, it's, you know, whatever I'm going to do. Okay, let's check some email. Like, you don't stop and think about it.
I think that's why it's so rewatchable because of that. It's right. So, and also, I just want to say, they do set up Cash's characters. Oh, pizza and frazzled. But he would have noticed his gun sight. Come on. Come on. Like, that's his gun. Like, he has a boot gun. Like, he would have known. I don't know. That's all I'm saying. I think you're right, John. Definitely for that. But this was fun. I'm glad we did this. This was a...
Well, I mean, it was inevitable.
Yeah. I mean, we're probably gonna have to go through all this stuff. What next? I kind of want to do... We don't have to decide now, but I want to do a Russell thriller. So
thriller? You mean like Breakdown?
Like Breakdown or Tequila Sunrise or
Dark Blue?
Unlawful Entry, Dark Blue.
Ooh, Unlawful Entry. Any of those. I'm in for any.
Oh, man. That's gonna... All right.
Can I pick the one that I've seen the most distantly from today?
Yeah, what?
Tequila Sunrise.
Tequila Sunrise? I mean, we got to get to Breakdown eventually, too.
That's a really good one, though. That's intense.
Man, I own them both, so it's not an issue. We'll decide later, but we have four.
Flip a coin.
Yeah, we can flip a coin. Could we put it up for a poll?
Put it up for a poll. Yeah, well, you know what? The listeners can pay. By the way, listeners, you're going to hear them both eventually.
Yeah, exactly.
This is just what you're going to hear next.
Okay, so we'll do that. We'll put up a poll, and we'll do Tequila Sunrise or Breakdown?
Yeah, that's a good pair.
I think I know what will win.
I have a feeling that Breakdown will win because most people won't know what Tequila Sunrise is.
Exactly. Tequila Sunrise, though. It's good. I mean, all Kurt Russell movies, though. Come on now. Tequila Sunrise. What year was Tequila Sunrise? 90?
91? Dot question mark?
1988. Wait, no.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Wait, Ann Will? No. Mel Gibson. No, that's 1988. Look at that cast. Mel Gibson, Michelle Pfeiffer, Kurt Russell, Raul Julia,
yeah.
Oh, man. Well, this was fun, man. Thank you for joining me. I had a great time doing this.
You know, my final thought is that I wish that they let James Hong be a little more James Hong-y.
Oh, yeah. This is weird seeing him be just a regular guy. I didn't like it.
he could have been an actor I never heard of. I'm happy to see him and be like, oh, from Big Trouble in Little China, great. But he was just I don't want to call him a throwaway, but it didn't matter that it was him, other than me just loving seeing him on screen.
I mean, he got a paycheck, so that's good.
And I like that they didn't shave Rakeen's shoulders. And when you saw the light shining from behind him before he electrocuted him, you see this bear-like tuft of arm and shoulder hair erupting from his tank top.
Oh, Gubna.
And he's all sweaty.
Oh, man.
He's a great villain in everything in which I can't think of the actor's name. I'm sorry to do him that momentary disservice. He is an amazing villain all the time. He's always like the head goon. He's in a movie.
Breon James, right? And he was also Fifth Element.
Yes, right. He was the colonel.
Yeah, General Monroe. And he's also in Kowalski in Blade Runner. Yeah, that dude had a good career.
Awesome.
Yeah, he had a great career. All right, well, hey, man. Thank you so much, John, for joining me. This was wonderful.
Cheers.
All right, so for me, Mark Hoffmeyer, for John Levengood, this is Movies, Films & Flicks. We'll see you next week.